This is a song I wrote back in 1972, 3 and part of 4.
Hi, this is Atsuko from Shonen Life, and you are listening to WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM.
Contract's a joke, but when you see smoke, you run toward the fire, cause you must. They all called your name when the crash finally came and left you to pick up the dust. I saw you walking in silence down to the bridge, but nothing went over the side. So I guess to someone with your heritage, withdrawal like consent is implied. And it's true,
Good morning, Medford. This is Max Landers, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Renford Tufts Freeform Radio. Welcome on. It's a beautiful Saturday morning. A little dark outside. A little cold outside as well. I just woke up about 15 minutes ago, and let me tell you, it was a shock. It was pretty tough to get out of bed. You may hear it in my voice, but my vocal cords are pretty shot. The rowing team and I went out Christmas caroling yesterday for all the whole campus. So we went around to, well, basically many hot spots around campus, the campus center, of course. Tony Monaco's house had to do it. Delta Tau Delta, we love those guys. All around campus and just spread the Christmas cheer. I think that it's very underrated. Christmas cheer is very underrated. We need more of it, especially as we go into final season. I hope that everyone's doing well. As finals ramp up, just remember to stay strong and pick yourself up. There's a lot that you can accomplish in a week. I know that I have a lot of learning to do, especially for my econ class, but in general. And that it's incredible that it's just going to be over very soon. The semester has gone by pretty quickly. It's pretty incredible how fast it goes by. As I sit here, I can't even really remember what I did last week. All the weeks kind of blur together, and I think that a lot of college students really feel that way. But yeah, anyways, I'm rambling. Today on our show, I do not have a guest. Well, it's hard to get someone to wake up at this hour in general, and well, it's finals week, so people are trying to get their rest before they get going. However, that does not mean that we do not have a guest on the show. I will be playing very shortly, a recording of an interview that I gave, well, I guess that I did, with one of my teachers. And this teacher in particular is named Adrian Cruz, great guy. He is a professor of sociology here at Tufts. I took his class called American Society, kind of just based on the course description, not really knowing what I was getting into. The class itself really mostly revolved around American problems, racial problems, social ills, whatever you would like to call them, and basically every day he would give us a general overview of a certain social issue and kind of explain why it's happening, why it's important that we analyze that social issue and so forth. Anyways, it was a great class. The guy himself is very entertaining. He's very well spoken. And you know, you may or may not agree with him, but he definitely has a lot to contribute, and I hope that I take a class with him in the future, that's for sure. So here we go. Why don't we just air this? And it's pretty interesting, I will say that. And also, you won't have to listen to my absolutely gravelly voice this fine morning. I'm actually somewhat coherent. Well, I'm coherent now, but just somewhat more pleasant to listen to, put it that way. All right. Hope you enjoy.
Record. All right, sounds great. All right, well, thank you for joining me today. This is sure. Dr. Cruz, a great teacher of mine. I guess the first question that I have is, could you help me understand and help the audience understand, like, what exactly is sociology, and also how did you get into that field?
Well, we'll try to keep it simple, right? As simple as we possibly can. Again, first of all, thanks for having me, Max. I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk to anyone, and glad to be on your show. I'm Adrian Cruz. I'm in the Department of Sociology at Tufts. You can find me in Breaker Hall, third floor. Anyway, sociology, I will define it very simply as the study of interaction. and the outcomes of those interactions. So in less than 1 minute, I'll say that interactions can be very simple and very complex. Interactions that can occur between obviously two people. Interactions occur between groups of people, and also getting very, what we would call micro sociological. We also have interactions with ourselves. We talk to ourselves, we communicate with ourselves. All of those different levels of interaction are part of what sociologists do. Obviously, this gets much more complicated as we begin to look at, you know, interactions between workers in a workplace, or between different racial and ethnic groups, or gender groups, or social class groups, or cities, or, you know, nation state interactions. You know, it becomes very, like I said, complex and requires a lot of analysis. That's how I would define sociology. How I got into it was very simply, it was very accidental. Years and years ago, when I was an undergraduate, I wish I had some deep story in which I can tell you that I read a book and a light went off and I was like, wow, amazing sociology. I mean, that did happen. But the reason I took took a course called Social Inequality many years ago as an undergrad, I had already taken Introduction to Sociology and loved it, but I didn't think much of it again. But the reason that I took that social inequality seminar was because it fit my schedule and it seemed interesting. I mean, the title of the course was Social Inequality, and it met for 2.5 hours once a week. So I signed up for it and I was like, okay, cool, let's do this. And I loved it, you know, and the last thing I'll say is the reason that I loved it, the course was called Social Inequality, or we could also call that social stratification. It just, you know, provided me with a vocabulary and tools to understand inequality, which I was incredibly fascinated with and concerned about. So that's how I got into it.
Wow, that's really cool. Would you say that's like changed your perspective over the years, and how has that like changed over time?
Has my perspective on sociology?
Yeah, or like how has, I guess, that class, like coming from that class, and how has sociology changed, like how you interact with people or how you see the world, or
Sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. After taking that course and then taking other courses, like, you know, courses in social theory, has, you know, introduced me to a discipline that, you know, I have to say, I mean, it sounds, I don't know if people will think this is weird or geeky or nerdy, but, you know, sociology is just, you know, always a part of the way that I approach the world. You know, it really got into me, if you want to put it that way. Yeah, I'm always, you know, I don't know how many sociology classes and seminars I've taken by, you know, over the last, whatever, through my undergraduate program, master's degree and PhD, I've sat in on so many sociology classes, but, you know, the opportunity to be sociological is always around us. It's always there. And a lot of us, whether many of us who have never taken a sociology class are already thinking sociologically. We just don't know that that's what it's called, or we can call it that. So yeah, it's, you know, it's broadened my perspective over the years. I think it, you know, this sounds so corny, but the one thing sociology has taught me over the years, and I'll keep it simple, is really simple, is everything changes. Everything will change, no matter, you know, technology, social structure, mannerisms, behaviors, slang. You know, I mean, your generation teaches me a lot about slang, terms I've never heard before. Students always introduce me to, you know, new words, and I'm like, what is that? You know, yeah. Everything changes. And I think that's good for us as we get older, to understand that things will change. And it's helped me avoid becoming a grouchy old man, I think. So I appreciate sociology, that sociology has done that for me.
All right. That's great. Wow. I guess transitioning to our first topic, which is whiteness. And we talked about this last class. Could you help me understand and help the audience understand what is whiteness? And I guess building off that idea of change that you were just talking about, how has that changed over time and how it's been expressed in American history?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, you know, first, again, sorry to be so, nerdy and geeky, but, you know, first thing I'll do is I'll provide a real quick reading list. If people want to read about whiteness, they can certainly look at the classic work of W.E.B. Du Bois, a great book. It's a very long book, Black Reconstruction in America. Alexander Sexton, the rise and fall of the White Republic. David Roediger's The Wages of Whiteness. George Lipsitz, The Possessive Investment in Whiteness, How White People Profit from Identity Politics. So just a few books that people can look at. Those are academic and scholarly, I understand that. But anyway, whiteness is, we defined it in classes just yesterday, and I'm also teaching race and ethnicity this semester. It's a system of advantages, a system of structural advantages that are based on race, that have existed throughout U.S. history for white folks, for a group of people who are categorized as white. Now, what's important to understand about that is that groups that we see as white today were not necessarily white 100 and, if we look at the first waves of Irish immigrants into the United States in the 1840s, the Irish were not seen as white. They became white. If you will, their identity evolved into whiteness. We would call that, racial formation. There was identity formation. It shifted and it changed over the course of time. So it's a system of advantages based on race. However, I think we should be clear about something that, when folks hear that, they think, well, they may think that a whiteness scholar is saying something like, oh, all white people have it good because they're white. And every white person out there has a great life. And of course, that's not true. I think that whiteness studies, or what we could also call critical white studies, just does a couple of things. Number one, it acknowledges and in a very exacting way argues that there is a racial category that is white. Because often when people think about race and ethnicity, they just think of groups of color. But I think that if we're going to talk and think about and study race and ethnicity, we have to understand that the dominant group, the white majority is also a group that has a racial identity, that they have defined themselves as white in many ways, although it's just much more, it's not something that has to necessarily be overtly expressed. It's a given. They're the dominant group. They're sort of the quote unquote standard. In the last 10 to 12 years, 6 years with the emergence of Trumpism, it seems now that we are witnessing a resurgence of groups who are asserting their white identity. So in class this week, we talked about we were talking about the Proud Boys, or we're going to talk about them. We had a good reading on them yesterday. White supremacist groups that are becoming more prominent, more vocal. They have a lot of different platforms from which they can, belt out their messages and their slogans. And yeah, that's the state of affairs that we live in right now.
Interesting. Okay, and this is just an off the cuff question that I have. So, do you think that Trumpism and that Trump as a political figure is something new? Do you think that he brings something new to the table and that's why white people are so drawn to him? Or is it kind of a resurgence of old ideas?
That is a really, really good question. I mean, is it the same old thing in a new package?
Yeah.
I would say that I think at first glance, I think the answer is yes. Right. The answer is yes. That, yes, it's the same old. But of course, remember what I just said about 10 minutes ago. Sociology teaches us that everything changes. Mm-hmm. So it is different. Right. I mean, this kind of vitriol and, this vitriol and this kind of, coded racist language. And sometimes it's not coded. It's taking place in a time that's very different. We had a black president for 8 years. Right. We have increasing diversity in the United States. It's not the 1930s. It's not 1866. Mm-hmm. Right. So it is a different time. We have higher rates of interracial marriage. Right. So it's not the same. I think because a lot of different things about the social structural context have changed, I think that changes the way people, you know, the way that message is transmitted and the way that it's received. It has to, one thing's for sure, it has to be delivered in a more, still, for the most part, has to, racist messages from someone like a head of state or other politicians have to be delivered in a more covert way, for sure. It can't be, it can't always, but they seem to sort of be moving towards a more sort of overt language. It's an interesting time, and I would argue dangerous too. Mm-hmm. You know, this is quite a dangerous moment. But that's a great question.
Yeah, it is a really interesting question, and it brings me back to just like populist movements. And I remember I studied for a time populism in like some of my history classes, and it just brings me back to that. And I wonder, like, how is that going to change, you know, politics in the nation? And you can just see how. I guess like my hope, like my parents' perspective and my personal perspective on politics has completely changed. And it just seems so much, it seems just so much more rhetorical and just kind of nasty. That makes sense.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, we can call it what, you know, we can say our politics are very tribal now. Mm-hmm. We have, and it's not just in the US, you know, we can make this a global discussion. We have, just this sort of increasing emphasis on, you know, us versus them.
Correct.
Know, us versus them. You're just so incredibly different from me that I don't want to see you. And I think in class, I've told you all at least once, I know I have, that even I am part of that, you know, part of that dynamic, you know, that if I see somebody wearing a MAGA hat, you know, I'm repelled, you know, this is not somebody who, I probably would not strike up a conversation with that person.
Right.
You know, I don't think I would. I don't think I'd sit next to them at a bar or something like that. I would move a few seats down, because not only for me, I want to say, just as a person of color, you know, a Mexican-American man, it's not just that I politically disagree with them. I would have some fear of, you know, of harm or violence coming my way. I really would. And I don't think that's a stretch, you know, to see some folks. I mean, I think January 6th demonstrated that to us. I don't think that's a stretch for me to, too much of a stretch for me to feel that way. But it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rhetoric that we hear now is pretty, it's brutal. It's really brutal. I don't know how we come back from this.
Yeah, it is. It's tough. Yeah, it is a tough situation, but I guess we'll see how things play out, you know, with the next presidential election. Maybe things will change. Yeah. All right. The second topic that I kind of wanted to cover is inequality in general between racial groups and how we address that and kind of the backlash to, I guess, different perceptions over that. And so my first question is, I guess this is another off the cuff question that kind of leads me to some other questions that I have here. But my first question is a common argument that I hear, because I love surrounding myself with people of different perspectives. A common argument that I hear from conservatives is, with respect to Black inequality, like they sometimes say, okay, we've had immigrants come into our nation. Asian immigrants is a good example, and here they have taken it upon themselves to, you know, here they are, they're Asian immigrants, and they've made a tons of money. They're relatively successful. They're, you know, they're marrying in high numbers and they're staying in these marriages. Why can't Black people just do that and pull themselves up by their bootstraps and model them?
Sure.
What's the difference?
Yeah, it's I've heard all of that before. First, let me just, you know, first of all, let's acknowledge that, yes, there are lots of immigrants who have come from all over the world to the United States and have been able to access what we would call upward social mobility. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, that's happened. Not just Asian immigrants, but folks from all other points on the planet as well, right? If we're talking about Asian Americans specifically, yeah, I mean, we could look at levels of, you know, educational achievement and median incomes, and we'll see, you know, high numbers, you know, for lots of Asian American groups. Not all, but for lots of them, certainly. That is true. You know, I think that, you know, we in immigration studies, we talk about something called the context of reception, okay? The context of reception. And also, that's immigration. If we're talking about race, and I'm using the work of Dorothy Roberts here, the legal scholar and sociologist, we understand that race is a political category. So racial categories are about power dynamics. The group, the category to which a group is assigned or positioned, has a lot to say about how they, what amount of power they're able to access within a social structure. So we want to think about race as a political category, and then we want to think about the context of reception, and I would say also migration for a group of people. In the case of Black folks, many of them in this country who are the descendants of slaves, obviously the context of migration and reception was one in which they were coerced. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, after being coerced, this coerced migration, they were property for a long time until 1865. And we can't stop there. We can't stop, you know, there was emancipation. But then there was an attempt at something called Reconstruction. Right. And you know, it's an understudied part of history, but Reconstruction could have been successful. It was not a done deal that Reconstruction was going to fail, but it did fail. And it's a failure of the U.S. state. Mm-hmm. that Reconstruction did not occur. And that doesn't mean just bringing up the South to the North's level. This also meant ensuring the political and legal rights of Black folks, after slavery. That did not happen. So they've had to live, Black folks have had to live with, faced what we would call oppression. So things like Jim Crowism, lynchings, that's not an experience that most other immigrant groups in the U.S. have had to experience. There has been, I'm going to say one more thing. In sociology, there's this understanding that racism is multidimensional. So what that means is that racism changes over time and that racism acts differently to different groups of color. Mm-hmm. So anti-Black racism is a distinct form of racism in the United States. It's about where the group started from and which political category, how this political category of race, which political category of race they were assigned to. And Black folks have been, disempowered in such a really atrocious way in the U.S. I mean, we got to be comparative about these things. The group's life history, if you will, has been one of just, not just subjugation, but I would argue the target of just hatred. Mm-hmm. In this history. And that's not to say other immigrant groups haven't experienced that as well. We use the example of the Irish, right? Sure. They were hated as well, upon arrival. They were Catholic. They were colonial subjects of the English, but they were able to access something called whiteness. Mm-hmm. In many instances, Black folks have not had that opportunity. If we want to see, so I guess what I want to say, and I'm not a social policy person, last thing I'll say, because it's a long answer, is if we want to see groups do well in the United States, if I can put it that way, have high levels of educational achievement, upward social mobility, let's craft solutions that are bespoke, that are tailored for that group's history and position within the country. There's not a one size fits all. And then I said that was the end of my answer, but I want to say one more thing. I think Black folks in the United States have done remarkably well. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a group of people that were slaves just 157 years ago? I think what they have achieved in terms of attaining civil rights and equality, I think it is nothing short of remarkable. Mm-hmm. Because often the government and much of the population worked against them. Right. I would call Black folks in this country an absolute success in many ways, and still there's more that needs to be done.
Of course. Okay, really interesting. All right, this is a big question that I have. I have it written down, and I've been pondering this question for a long time, and I often think about it with respect to term and inequality, because obviously there is, the oppression side of inequality. The oppression causes this inequality, and it's an awful thing. But I think that there's also other components that tie into this as well. So this statistic is pretty shocking, and I'll just read out the question. Many people believe that and conservatives in particular, but many people in general believe that the situation of Black individuals is a result of other factors other than the oppression of whites alone. One of the statistics that they cite is that the single motherhood rate of Black Americans, so children born to unmarried mothers, went from around 30%, roughly 30% in 1965 to 73% today. What do you think has caused this trend, or is there just not one answer?
Well, that's a great question. We're getting into issues of, you know, sociology, certainly race and ethnicity and family. You know, I'm not an expert on it, so I can't sit here and give you the exact cause of that. But I'm going to go back to the tail end of my last answer, which is I think that I'm thinking of a very famous book called All Our Kin by Carol Stack, a sociologist. Mm-hmm. All Our Kin, and in it, you know, Professor Stack, you know, analyzes the way in which actually the Black family has been remarkably resilient. It has held itself together. They have held themselves together through a lot of dire circumstances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this goes back to, you know, let's, you know, in the last answer, there was this comparison of, you know, Asian immigrants to Blacks, right? Sure. I mean, you know, and like, why have Asians, certain, you know, a lot of Asian groups and their kids been able to, you know, move up in the world and be very successful in the U.S.? Mm-hmm. I just want to say a couple of things. I mean, number one, let's think about how we define success.
Sure.
What does it mean to be successful? Is success simply about, you know, having high levels of, you know, high median incomes and home ownership and high levels of education? For some people, maybe. Or is success about how much distance a group of people have traveled over the course of time in moving up within a social structure that has often worked against them? So I want to link that to this discussion of family, because this is really about family and gender and race and class. How do we define family? The first thing, you know, there's a lot I keep saying. The first thing I want to say, I think that if a woman, any woman who's a single mother, right, first of all, I think almost all the time, overwhelming amount of the time, that is a mother who is working very hard to take care of their kid.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that there's, you know, it's quite significant. It's important to note that. Mm-hmm. Why the family has dissipated? I mean, you know, we'd have to get into an analysis of, you know, the struggles of Black men, mm-hmm. the kind of barriers they may face in employment, education. There's this issue of gender, and so I wouldn't be able to give an exact answer as to why there has been, you know, that problem. I will say that I think that there should be more support for single mothers, you know. Mm-hmm. And that regardless of how people want to answer that question or what they think the causes are,
right,
I don't think we should penalize kids for something that they don't control, right? I think the children should still get the things that they need, you know, good school, food, a place to live, a good, clean place to live and thrive. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's our responsibility for all children, right? For all kids. I mean, you noted before we started this interview, you noted that your parents situated themselves in a really nice suburb of Portland. Right. So that you, and I don't know if you have siblings or not, but at least you were able to access a very, very good public high school education. Right. I mean, that's terrific. And I think that that's really wonderful that you have parents that were able to do that. But I think a lot of parents who don't have the money to do that would love to do that.
Right.
You know, and I think for them, they would ask probably, why can't I just have a really good school in my neighborhood?
Yeah.
You know, why do I have to move to this other place? Why does the Landers family have to move to some other suburb and out of Portland in order to access a good public high school education or the best? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can't we all access the best anyway?
No, I agree with that. That's very true. Yeah. All right. The last couple questions I have, there are probably only one or two, are over critical race theory. And this kind of goes back to whiteness and the backlash to critical race theory. Could you help the audience and me understand critical race theory?
Sure. I mean, critical race theory is very simply about putting the voices and experiences of people of color at the center of analysis of race and racism. It is about, rather than seeing folks of color as a problem, it recognizes, you know, because often, you'll the Black problem, the Latino problem, rather than seeing a group of people as a problem, understand that certain groups of people, because of racial dynamics and racial inequality, they have problems.
Right.
They're not a problem. No group of people is a problem in and of themselves because of their racial identity. So critical race theory is about putting that at the center and acknowledging and confronting a history of racial inequality in the U.S. There are some folks out there that interpret critical race, that CRT, I'll just abbreviate it like that. They interpret CRT as white bashing or guilting white people, you know. And I understand that there could be some defensive reactions. We talked about white fragility in class just yesterday, right?
That's right.
And I understand that there may be some defensive reactions to that. But, you know, I get that, but I would invite all of us to come into the conversation. And, you know, how would our history classes look different if we put Black folk, how would a class on the Civil War look like if we put Black folks at the center of the analysis, mm-hmm. rather than Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant and Abraham Lincoln? Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about perspective all the time. And so I think that that kind of class and analysis, it would look different.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put groups of people who have often been decentered or marginalized, let's place them at the center. And let's hear their stories and their experiences, rather than telling them, oh, no, that wasn't racist. You know, but if a person of color is saying, no, I think I was the target, or, you know, often folks of color, they're not believed. And critical race theory is a scholarly endeavor to address that shortcoming. Sure. Within, so that's the best I can do for right now in terms of defining it.
Well, that was a great definition. And I guess the last question I have is, why do you think there is so much backlash to CRT? Because a lot of it just seems, at least when I watch interviews online, it all just seems like very nebulous. It's just like, no, this is just attacking, you know, my kid doesn't know anything about race. Why does he have to learn it now? He's too young. Right. Again, like you said, it seems like white bashing. So why do you think there's that reaction from parents?
No, I'm going to steal an answer. I was one of the sociology profs. Here in sociology, Frieden Blume Orr, he invited a sociologist at the University of Iowa named Victor Ray, who has just released a book on critical race theory and is an advocate for using critical race theory. And in this book, he advocates for CRT and defends it. And he came to the class, of the social theory class, via Zoom. And I was invited, other professors were invited to just, because, you know, he's becoming quite famous. And I wanted to hear too, right? So, okay, let's hear what this guy has to say. And he got this question. So I'm basically stealing someone else's answer,
sure.
or using, but I want to cite where the answer came from, the answer I'm about to give. So this is Victor Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. And I'm forgetting the name of the book. And now since we're here, I just, you know, I know that we're recording this. Victor Ray, and the book is on critical race theory. On critical race theory, why it matters and why you should care. That's the name of the book. So, you know, he got a question like this from one of the students in the class. And his answer was so simple. He said, you know, I think, you know, the reason a lot of these parents are opposed to CRT is because they may not want their kids to come home from school and start asking their parents questions about the family, about things like, hey, you know, hey, grandma, hey, grandpa, you know, hey, mom, hey, dad, did grandpa ever use the N-word? You know, have you ever used the N-word? Have you, do you have any Black friends? They don't want, they're going to get, because kids do that, right? They'll come home, they'll ask all kinds of questions, you know, and maybe parents don't want to hear that. They don't want their 9-year-old or 10-year-old to come and talk to them or ask them these kinds of questions. Those are some penetrating questions. Again, here we go again with defensiveness, right? Can you imagine a 10-year-old, 11-year-old saying, why do we live in an all-white neighborhood? You know, I mean, why are predominantly white? I don't understand. Can you? And I think that should be in a country that's so multiracial. If somebody lives in a mostly white neighborhood, I mean, I think that I think that requires some explanation, right? And you don't have to be defensive about it. You know, I'm Latino. I mean, I live in a white neighborhood. So if I had a kid, I'd have to answer that question. You know, people could ask me that, you know. But anyway, that was Professor Ray's answer. And I think that for right now, that's the answer I'll go with.
That's a very good answer. I've never thought about it that way, where it's
neither had I.
He's going to start questioning me and asking me these hard questions that, sure, you know, I am not comfortable sharing with, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I guess what I'd like the parents to know is, it's kind of funny. So I don't want my kid learning critical race theory and say, hey, why don't you come with your kid to class and you learn CRT?
Yeah.
You can also learn CRT. I will help you answer that question. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just confront it? You know, if we acknowledge and confront these things, we will all be better off, I think. Even if you don't necessarily end up subscribing to some of the arguments about the causes of racial inequality that CRT advances, you can at least acknowledge, I mean, do you live in a mostly white neighborhood? And if the answer is yes, well, then let's get to the bottom of that at least, right? I think it's worth it to investigate that. But how can we do that unselfconsciously and comfortably? There's got to be a moment of discomfort, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the way you do it is through conversations like this, where you just kind of lay out the facts and talk about opinions. Sure. And whether you disagree or agree, it doesn't really matter. I think that it's just getting the information out and just like hearing things from another perspective. That's the most important thing. And with that, unfortunately, it says I only have 3 minutes left in the meeting, but thank you very much, Dr. Cruz. That was very informative. I'm really glad that we could do this. And that was very, very interesting.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And I hope, I don't know if y'all do ratings, but I hope the ratings are through the roof.
Oh, they will be. I'm sure all six of my listeners will be utterly engrossed. So,
see you later, Max. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Wow. Hello. Okay, anybody? Oh, there we go. Now we're on the air. Well, thanks for listening. Just overall, a very, very informative conversation with Dr. Cruz. The guy is just so well spoken. Listen to me right now. I got all kinds of filler words going on, but he can just belt it out, and it's just very impressive. He has a lot. There's a lot going on in that head. And just overall, very well spoken, very knowledgeable, very likable, relatable guy. Really appreciate having him as a teacher. Here, 1 second. There we go, that's all better. I guess I can briefly just discuss my thoughts on the issue, on the issues that we talked about. I guess we just talked about critical race theory, definitely a very contentious topic in the United States. What's interesting to me is that critical race theory is something that is just, it's a term that's been tossed around a lot in the media. It's tossed around a lot by parents and in schools, etc. But I think a lot of people don't really know what exactly that term entails, what that term means when it comes to the curriculum that kids experience on a day-to-day basis. And while maybe there is a hard definition, like he said, it's the kind of emphasis and elevation of voices of color in history class, when we're discussing what America is all about and confronting our history. I don't know exactly what that means. And I think that I'm definitely for that. I think it's important to discuss the history of everyone, because the history of all racial groups in America is the history of America itself. This goes on to another topic, but that's one of my problems with the, you know, Black History Month and Asian History Month and this is what I'm kind of taking a quote from Morgan Freeman. What Morgan Freeman has said in the past is, why would you relegate the history of a single racial group to a month when in reality it should be elevated and discussed and studied and appreciated, regardless, put it that way. Going back to critical race theory, I think that with young kids in particular, you have to be very, very careful with your signaling. especially around topics such as this where it's heavy. I think that, you know, when I was a kid, man, in middle school, sure, middle school, maybe early, even early high school and elementary school, man, I didn't know, I like race was not really a thing that I thought about on a day-to-day basis, you know? And maybe that's because of where I lived, where everybody kind of had the same tone of skin, but in general, it really was not an issue. And I didn't know what racism was. I couldn't tell you what it meant to be, like what it means to be a racist and what and how racism affects everybody. It just wasn't in my mind. And so I think that for a lot of kids, especially in areas that are predominantly white, it would be really, really hard for them to understand like what exactly racism is. And so if you teach them, if you were to teach a group of middle schoolers, hypothetically, whites are the oppressors. They always have been. They may always will be at this point, and that all these other racial groups are subject to this, their oppression. I think that that signaling could be potentially really harmful in a sense. And, you know, or maybe it's the right answer, maybe it's not, but I think that kids have the tendency to take things to the extreme, and I think it's just generally a bad idea to tell kids of any racial group, this is where you stand. You are above or you are below, and that's where you are and where you always be in the social hierarchy. I think that's just a negative thing. I think that the best way that you get people to confront racism, and I've said this on my last podcast, is through experience. You have to somehow, in some way, shape, or form, create an environment where people are pursuing people regardless of race, people of all colors, you could be green, purple, white, black, whatever, are pursuing the same goal and are working together to pursue the same goal. And actually a good example of this is blues music. And I remember John Mayer, of all people, saying, when you're on stage, or I believe it was John Mayer, or some blues musician, if you're on stage with these blues musicians, it doesn't matter what color you are. What you're doing is you're creating the music together and you're working towards the goal of furthering and developing blues music. And I think that could be that's very applicable to basically anything. As long as you're pursuing a goal, a shared goal with people around you who are similarly motivated, racism doesn't matter, you know? That's my thought about that. When it comes to, what was the other topic? So we talked about critical race theory briefly and a little bit about race. Family. This is a topic that I don't know a ton about. So I'll kind of just like riff about my thoughts. But when I first heard that statistic about 70% of the, like, of black people being born to single mothers, I thought that was pretty shocking. And, you know, there are different ways you can measure single motherhood, and, you know, maybe they're married, maybe they're not, etc. But regardless, I thought that was a pretty shocking statistic. And overall, I would say that the children in general, regardless of racial group, are being born into environments where they only have one parent. And I think that's just utterly awful. This goes back to behavioral things, but I think that just not having a father figure in the house or wherever you live is detrimental to both the development of boys and girls. I think that, like Dr. Cruz kind of mentioned, I think having only one parent supporting their kids, think about it, a single motherhood working tirelessly to feed their kids and juggling all these tasks, you know, managing their education, working their butt off at work to try and get food on the table, as well as, you know, nurture their kids to become, you know, ultimately, or at least try to become successful in the future. I think that it's almost impossible for me to fathom that kind of thing. And it makes me realize how lucky I am to have grown up in a stable household with parents who are both invested in my future and who seem to divide the responsibilities of parenting pretty well. And so I can imagine, you know, of course there probably is, you know, some level of racism, you know, systemic racism that black people experience. And I don't know the answer to that. I think that, you know, I don't know what the scope of systemic racism is, put it that way. But I think that the effects of family are just, are very, very, very important. I think that they are not talked about enough. And it's also a problem that's pervasive and will be difficult to solve because it's very hard to change, cultural behaviors, put it that way, systemic cultural behaviors with government policy. It's very hard to change systemic cultural behaviors with government policy because they're just that. They're systemic behaviors within a certain social group. Let's see, what else did we kind of touch on? Trumpism, I don't know. I don't really want to talk about Trump, honestly. That guy kind of just makes me angry. For a while, I could tolerate him. Believe it or not, you know, he's a funny guy. He's definitely entertaining. And, you know, the economy is pretty good before COVID. And people actually were, in general, weren't hating him too much. And he seemed to be doing not incompetent, but a mediocre job in office. But I think, like, just over the course of the last 2 years, and this is just my perception as someone who kind of detests politics in a sense. I don't love it. It kind of grosses me out. but he's just kind of gone off the rails, and just kind of educating myself over like what he has said in the past and educating myself more on just kind of his sleazy, like, I guess, like, just recently the Trump Organization kind of got indicted on tax fraud, for example. So just his kind of sleazy behavior and just the things he says to just get his base riled up and activated his voting base, it just turns me off so much. And I think it's just very, very unfortunate that we have to stoop down to people like him and frankly Biden as well to lead our country and be the figurehead of our nation. Because in a sense, I think that's what a president should be. I think the president should be something that inspires people and who brings people together. And I guess one person who did do that actually is Obama. I remember, you know, I have gripes with Obama's policy and the things he did, but one thing that he did do, I think, to many people is he inspired people. And I actually recently watched one of his speeches online. I think it was at one of the Democratic conventions, and I remember just like watching him speak. It's very inspirational. He's very well spoken, and what he does is he appeals to everybody in some way, regardless of racial group, regardless of who you are, you know, socially, where you are economically. He appeals to you and he makes you feel heard, and that's something I think that we do not see today, either with Trump or Biden. Absolutely not. So just two very interesting styles of leading and speaking that I can comment on. I guess we're wrapping up today. I'll leave you with just some best wishes. The Christmas break is coming soon. Christmas is a very important time. It's one of the best times of the year. You know, the Christmas music comes on and you're in your car and it's cold outside and you got your jacket on, and it's just this whole, it's a feeling that you can always come back to every single year, right? And also, of course, there's the magic of leading up to Christmas Day and the food's very important. As we know, the food is very, very important. Especially, you know, eating with your family. I think that whole ritual is, well, I'm looking forward to it, but I think it's a good tradition, put it that way. It's whoever started the Christmas tradition of the dinner and breakfast and lunch and all those things with your family, hey, good job. That's what I say. But anyways, Christmas, or whatever you practice coming into the holiday season, I hope you have a good one. Especially to those university students out there who are, you know, I look out the window. No one's in the library just yet, but I saw some people suffering late on a Friday night, and we caroled to them, and maybe we made their day. That's the best we can do. But anyways, yes, have a good Christmas. Have a good break. Appreciate you all for tuning in tonight. Or not tonight. I'm so sorry. This fine morning. Stay cool. This is Max Landers. You are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Signing out. Have a good one.
Drink while you can, but you won't forget.